Welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining us tonight for this bi-monthly conflict-free leadership call hosted by the National Physicians Alliance as part of its unbranded doctor project, which was actually expanded under the Partnership to Advance Conflict-Free Medical Education, which we refer to, as Rachel would say very fondly, as TACME. I'm Ann Wallace, and I'm the facilitator for the call tonight. And I am the Director of Education for the National Physicians Alliance. And again, I thank you for joining us for this call. According to our pre-registrations, as of earlier today, we have a good mix of physicians, faculty, and students from all across the country on this call. And we have several states represented. I'll mention a couple: California, Connecticut, D.C., Florida, Maryland, Minnesota, New York, Pennsylvania, Tennessee. We have someone from Virginia, Washington, as we just heard, West Virginia, and I'm from Maine, and I believe we have a few others registered today. So welcome, everybody. It's great to have folks from all across the country joining us, and I appreciate it very much. And as Becky Martin just previously mentioned, we're going to ask that people mute your lines so we can all hear better. And in case you missed the instructions, in order to mute, you would press star 6. And then later on in the call, should you have a question, during the question and answer discussion period, just push star 6 again and we'll be able to hear you. So thank you for taking care of that. Just really quickly, a little background on the TACME project. The grant supports this stems from a settlement regarding the inappropriate marketing of the drug Neurontin. Partners for the grant include the National Physicians Alliance, the American Medical Student Association, Community Catalyst, and the Pew Charitable Trust. The goal of the project is to reduce conflicts of interest created by the pharmaceutical industry in the medical profession and medical research. The partners on this grant promote a number of approaches to raise awareness of the issue and to build leadership in the medical profession and at medical schools to eventually eliminate some conflicts, which is why it's really wonderful that we have physicians, faculty, and students on the call tonight. Our topic tonight is recognizing conflict of interest at medical schools, reducing COI through curriculum development. And our featured speaker is Dr. Steve Smith, Professor Emeritus of Family Medicine at Warren Albert Medical School of Brown University. He retired in 2007 as Associate Dean, a post he held for 25 years, and during his tenure as Associate Dean, he earned an international reputation for innovation in medical education. He was the architect of the competency-based curriculum at Brown and has been replicated at many medical schools around the world. Dr. Smith is a consultant to the Partnership to Advance Conflict-Free Medical Education, TACME, this project. He also served as principal investigator of the Good Stewardship Project of the National Physicians Alliance, funded by the American Board of Internal Medicine Foundation, which has since grown into the Choosing Wisely campaign, which folks should check out on the National Physicians Alliance website if you're not familiar with Good Stewardship. It's a wonderful project. Finally, Steve earned his degree from Boston University School of Medicine in 1972 and his Master of Public Health degree from the University of Rochester. He's going to discuss how teaching about conflicts of interest can serve as a portal into the wider domain of professionalism and health justice. And he will describe tools and resources available, including conflict of interest curriculum toolkit developed by this project as a policy guide. So I'm going to stop right there for just a second and just add, there is somebody who doesn't have their phone on mute because I seem to be getting some static or some feedback from somebody. So I'll just ask people once again to mute your phone by pressing star 6. Steve is going to talk for about 20 minutes, and then we will have hopefully The new ANSA Just Medicine Fellow, Chantrice, joined us. I'm not sure if she has made it on the phone yet or not, who will provide an initial response and tell us about ANSA's work in this area and resources available. And I think the only other thing that I want to mention is in the past we've asked people to email me questions during the call, which you are certainly welcome to do. We are going to try to open things up after our speakers today, sort of an open mic, which we've done a little bit in the past and it's worked well. So I guess we have a choice. You can either save your questions for after our speakers, and so it's sort of a more interactive conversation, or you're certainly welcome to email me questions at, I'm going to spell out my email address, it's ann.woloson@mpalliance.net. So it's ann.woloson@mpalliance.net. I'm going to stop there and let Steve start his presentation, and then I'll give a little bit of a project update at the end of the call. So without further ado, thank you, Steve, for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you, Anne, and I want to thank the National Physicians Alliance for this opportunity to talk on the leadership call. And, you know, as Anne has mentioned, we're going to do things a little bit different tonight, to talk a little bit, but then I want to spend at least half, or hopefully more than half of the hour that we have, hearing from everybody who's on the call, because you're all experts. Whether you're medical students or residents or practicing docs or retired docs like me, you know, you've all been through it, and I really want to hear from you, so that's our plan tonight. Anne mentioned the PACME project, the Partnership for Advancing Conflict-Free Medical Education, and I got involved with that a few years ago because I really think that when you think about conflict of interest, it's really a much broader concept than that, and it really gets at the heart of professionalism. If you take a look at the relationships between physicians and industry, that relationship can be very problematic and get at the essence of what it means to be a doctor, you know, using the science in the best way we can, the best evidence we can for our patients, and turning away from the siren songs of profit-driven industry and making decisions based on really what's best for our patients and nothing else. As Anne mentioned, yeah, I think that teaching about conflict of interest is really a wedge into much broader issues of professionalism. You know, it gives us an entree into raising the consciousness of our students and our residents and even our fellow doctors about, you know, the special social compact between medicine and the public good, and also talk about our special fiduciary responsibilities, relationships between the doctor and the patient. Yeah, I think the other thing that's terribly important is that as we, as physicians, teach our students about conflict of interest and raise these issues of professionalism, we're really role modeling what we think is the right behavior as physicians to take in terms of these relationships. And I just don't think you can underestimate how powerful simply being a role model can be in influencing the behavior of our trainees. So like I said, I'm going to do a little bit of talking about some of my own experiences and how I came to understand the issues of conflict of interest, how I learned about it, and then I want to hear from all of you as well. Yesterday when I was in seeing the patient, I brought my little black bag with me that I had from medical school. It's kind of battered like me. You know, patients think it's cute. You know, but I got that, you know, a million years ago from the Eli Lilly drug company. And, you know, when I got it, I didn't even think twice about it. The whole concept of a conflict of interest when I was a first-year medical student really hadn't dawned on my consciousness at all. I think the first time I really began to understand it, I was in an AMSA project, actually. It was called the Appalachian Student Health Project. And at the end of my second year, I spent the summer in a small Appalachian community with a great doctor, a guy named Bob Horsch, who I thought was really caring for his patients, really a wonderful guy. But I began to observe that, you know, he was doing things like using some brand new antibiotics that were not exactly narrow spectrum for things that I had been taught in medical school. You know, you should use, like, if you have a strep throat, you should use the most narrow spectrum antibiotic, like penicillin. And certainly in the 1960s, almost all strep was sensitive to penicillin. But he was using these new broader spectrum cephalosporins that were quite expensive. And I just couldn't figure out, you know, why was this happening? And that was my first introduction to drug detailers, you know, who came to the office and brought their samples and told him about the latest and greatest and most expensive drugs available. And he was describing them, and I was sort of scratching my head at that about, you know, what is this thing all about? I guess my next, if you go forward to my residency, I was on the PNC, the Pharmaceutical and Therapeutics Committee of my hospital in Rochester, and I observed, I was beginning to get more sensitized to the issues of cost, because we had a fairly indigent population and drugs were expensive. And I noticed that on our formulary, again, this was like the early 70s, we used polycillin, which was the Bristol drug company's brand of ampicillin. And I had known from some studies that I did of cost of pharmaceuticals that polycillin was the most expensive form of ampicillin that was available out there. And I asked the pharmacist in our committee, I said, well, why are we, you know, using polycillin in the hospital? Why is that on our formulary? It's the most expensive form of ampicillin there is. And the pharmacist corrected me. He said, no, he says, it's actually not. He says, we put this out to bid, and Bristol submits the lowest bid for ampicillin, and that's why we stock it in the hospital. And I was kind of wondering how is that possible? Because I knew it was the most expensive. And then I realized that by putting in the lowest bid for the hospital inpatient use of the drug, it was getting us used to that brand, so that when we wrote the prescriptions for outpatient, which is where the biggest market was, you know, we would use the word polycillin rather than ampicillin. Those were in the days before generic substitution was allowed. And I began to see how drug companies were marketing things, and that was quite troublesome to me. So let's forward ahead quite a few years, many decades, in fact. A few years ago, I was visiting a colleague of mine, Ira Gessner, down at the University of Florida on a medical education project we were working on. But he invited me to come to a lunch meeting with the students there at the University of Florida. They had just come back from a two-week program, an intercession program, where they spent 2 weeks with the practicing docs up in northern Florida. And the lunch meeting was for them to kind of debrief and talk about their experience. We were going around the room, and I was just going to sit there and be quiet and listen to the stories. And got to this one young man, first-year medical student, and he was telling his colleagues, he said, oh, boy, he said, we had the best time. He said, my doctor, he got invited to a restaurant. It was, you know, like the most expensive restaurant in town. I can't remember if it was Ruth's Chris or what, you know, and all free drinks and these great steaks. And, you know, it was really fantastic. And he invited me along. He was just so excited about this. And he was telling the students about it and have them, they listened to a presentation on a new drug. And although I had intended to say quiet through this whole thing, I just couldn't hold myself back. And this was before I got involved with the PATHMIC program. So I just interjected, and I said to the student, do you realize that the person who was speaking about that drug, the doctor who you were listening to, was actually a paid spokesman from the drug company that produced that drug? And this is really just a way of marketing it and getting doctors to prescribe this. The student had no idea whatsoever that this was actually what was happening. And as soon as he heard that, his entire attitude changed 180 degrees. And he was indignant that he had been manipulated by that, and that this was, you know, a form of marketing by the drug companies, and he was like frothing at the mouth, you know. And then, I told him about AMSA and getting involved with their, at the time it was called Farm Free, now it's called Just Medicine Project, and he was going to go ahead and do that. I tell you that story because, I think it illustrates sort of the first principle, the first competency, if you will, in how we can teach about conflict of interest, and that's simply raising awareness. You know, like I said, when I was a first-year medical student, I was completely unaware. But I think given my values, and I think probably the values that most of you who are on the phone call tonight share, you know, I would have, like the student at Florida, I would have been quite indignant and much more reflective about, you know, maybe I shouldn't have taken that stethoscope from Lilly or the black bag as well. So, as an approach to medical education, the first thing I think we need to do is raise awareness and let students know what's going on and, in fact, that they are being manipulated. And I think in most cases, you'll find that the students don't like being manipulated and they'll get quite angry about that. You know, once we've done that, then I think the next step is to have them appreciate that, you know, this isn't just a matter of manipulation and smart marketing, but that actual harms can come from this. We can use stories like the Vioxx story on how aggressive marketing and illegal marketing, you know, led to the deaths of many people. This really has a tremendous impact on our patients as well. I think we can then try to relate the inappropriateness of some of the marketing tactics to what we should be doing, you know, as professionals. You know, how do we approach prescribing? How do we get the information for our patients that's comes from an unbiased source and really takes into account not only the science but also the cost as well for the patients? And, if we do this and we do this well, and I think we sort of won the hearts of the students, then we can get kind of into the weeds, into some of the details, especially for the students who are particularly interested in this, some of the social science, you know, about how drug companies use the psychology of food, flattery, and friendship, you know, to win over doctors and make them feel obligated and have a sense of wanting to return a favor. We can get into how drug companies use ghostwriting, you know, as a way of really inserting marketing into what should be science. Talk about speakers bureaus and things like that. So we can really get into some of the details of how marketing occurs. I think ultimately what we want to do is to get students to commit themselves to being the best prescribers they can be for their patients, using unbiased sources of information, such as the medical letter and other sources like that. And ultimately, the ultimate goal would be to get them on calls like this and being future leaders in the whole area of trying to make sure that the relationships between physicians and medicine and industry are appropriate ones. I'm just going to touch on a couple of methods of teaching that we've got in our toolkit, on curriculum. And with the announcement that you had, there's a link, so you can just click on that link, and that'll take you to the toolkit on curriculum, which is more detailed. And there's also actually resources, PowerPoints and so on, that you can access from that as well. But in terms of teaching, you know, I think we can think of some innovative ways of doing it. And one of the problems is that if you ask most doctors, you know, they'll say, I can't be bought off with a sandwich. You know, just because they bring in lunch doesn't mean, you know, that I'm going to believe everything and so on. And they truly believe that they won't be influenced when we know that the data is very clear that they are influenced. They may think that their colleagues are influenced, though. It's quite interesting if you ask, well, not me, but, you know, I don't know, that Dr. Jones, that Dr. Smith, I'm not so sure about him. So one approach to this is what we call hoodwinking, and my good friend and colleague Michael Wilkes used this approach at the University of California at Davis about 10 years ago. And this is to kind of break down that that myth of invincibility that us doctors have. It's a myth, it's an illusion, but sometimes getting at it indirectly is the best way. And what he did was he got hospital pharmacists to play the role, unbeknownst to the students, of drug detailers. So Michael Wilkes introduced them as representatives of pharmaceutical companies who were going to talk to them about, actually I think what they did at the time, this was around 2001, was talking about non-sedating antihistamines. And so the clinical pharmacist playing the role of the drug detailer told the students about this new product and then left. And then the preceptors started asking the students, well, what do you think of this? And, you know, all the students were generally, you know, very, very impressed that this is like a wonder drug and so on. And then, you know, he sprung it on them that, in fact, you know, these were not pharmaceutical representatives, they're actually clinical pharmacists, brought the clinical pharmacist back in the room, and the clinical pharmacist told them how they had manipulated the data, had presented it in a way that emphasized benefits, minimized risks, basically all the things that drug detailers do, and basically had hoodwinked the students into believing that these drugs were better than they actually were. And again, when this happens, you're able to, and then have the students reflect on this illusion of invulnerability, make them sensitive to the fact that, you know, these marketers are very, very slick. They're very well trained. We have to be aware of that. Another technique is what we call debunking. And it's a little less tricky. It's pretty straightforward, and that is, you know, you tell the students, these are the things to be aware of. These are the kinds of things that, you know, will present an unbalanced view of a drug and its benefits and side effects. And then either, you know, do role plays, sort of open label, if you will, open label role plays, or actually take a look at some advertising and have the students critique that. The FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, actually has a campaign called the Bad Ad Campaign, where they take particularly egregious ads and use it to train medical students to pick up, you know, where things have gone astray. And once you do that, it sort of immunizes the students to these practices, and the next time they become much more skeptical of that and are able to analyze them much better. A third approach, which I think is very powerful, is what we call putting a face on the problem, and that is telling stories. My good friend at Dartmouth, David Nirenberg, who teaches a course on clinical pharmacology, tells the students about a medical student who prescribed you know, a very expensive antibiotic for a young kid with otitis media. A couple days later, that kid was admitted with meningitis, lived fortunately, but I think had some serious neurological consequences of that. And the student was terribly upset about her, with herself for having done that. Turns out that the antibiotic was so expensive that the mother couldn't afford it. She didn't have insurance and didn't get the prescription filled. And the reason she had prescribed that is she had just come from a drug company sponsored lunch on why this antibiotic, you know, was the absolute best for otitis media. You know, maybe in a test tube it was, but in terms of practical terms, it was the wrong thing. And, you know, she was blaming herself. Dr. Nirenberg, you know, pointed out to her that, you know, she really shouldn't blame herself so much as blaming the drug company for its unbalanced and biased presentation. So telling stories like that can be, you know, extremely positive and powerful. Probably the least effective approach is lectures. We all do it, but probably not the best way to do it. You know, if we are going to do that, you know, using cases, telling stories is probably a way to liven up those lectures better. Again, I just wanted to point out the toolkit that is available. You can click on the link that we've given you, and there are PowerPoints there. There are PDFs from a variety of schools that have done some really interesting things, from Einstein and Texas, Iowa, a number of really things. And all those folks are very pleased to share those resources with you. You know, you can take them and adapt them as you like. So I'm going to ask, is Jantrice on the call right now? Yes? No? Jantrice Appleby is the new Just Medicine Fellow from the American Medical Student Association. And I was hoping she would join. Oh, you're on.
Yeah, this is Ann, and she is on the phone. Jantrice, I believe you're still on the phone. She did email to tell me she was on. If you press star 6, that would unmute you. Hello?
Yep. There we go. I'm just going to introduce Jantrice. She's, as I said, she's the Just Medicine Fellow from the American Medical Student Association. I wanted to have her have a couple of minutes to give the perspective of students as well. And then after that, I want to hear from everybody on the call. You know, what lit your fire? I kind of gave you a little bit of a story of my background and my experiences and how I got interested in this. I'd love to hear from everybody, including some of those older guys. I know Dick is on the phone and Mary Lou. You know, us old folks have to tell our stories, so I want to hear from you. And what do you think is the most effective way to learn about conflict of interest and industry relationships? So but right now, let's hear from Jantrice.
Hi, I am the new Just Medicine Fellow with CAMHSA, and basically just to give a little background about myself, prior to being a Just Medicine Fellow and joining the Just Medicine campaign, I did not really think that I had come into contact with any issues involving conflicts of interest until I kind of met other students and met physicians and heard stories, and I thought about my days of shadowing with physicians and I was just eat lunch for free, and I would always want to come in on Fridays just because that's when the reps would come in and do their presentations and speak with the physicians. And, you know, at that time, I didn't really think there was much harm to it. I just thought they were providing information. And, you know, even at the same time, after doing research and, you know, being with AMHSA and learning a lot about conflict of interest policy and medical education and the physicians practicing as well, I realized that, you know, that is a ploy. And I did see when I looked back at it, I did see the trend of the physicians prescribing those particular medications more because they were presenting side effects on the people that, you know, sugar-coated all of the infants. They felt comfortable after their encounter prescribing this to their patients. But I'm also
You're crackling up. Yeah, you're crackling up just a little bit. I don't know if there's a place that you can be where we could avoid that a little bit. I just thought I would let you know so we don't miss what you have to say.
Okay. I'm sorry about that. Can you hear me slightly better now?
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
It's better.
Okay. Thank you. No problem. Well, just to get some information about the Just Medicine campaign and AMHSA's scorecard, the AMHSA scorecard, it was launched in 2007, and basically what it does is it provides an objective evaluation of conflict of interest policies and curriculum for about over 150 medical institutions. And the scorecard is something that we hope is an evolving tool. So within the last year, we actually have revised our methodology to ensure that it really reflects, you know, the most up-to-date language and assessment domains for our medical schools. And in addition to those updates, we also plan to introduce a scorecard that is specifically for medical centers and teaching hospitals. And basically, we hope that these new additions will encourage medical schools to continue to basically reinforce and emphasize evidence supported clinical education and patient-centered medical care above any other interest outside of, you know, dealing with pharmaceutical companies and having large interactions with how they educate our rising physicians. Also, in September, we plan on doing, I guess, our hard launch for our AMSA scorecard, which will have the medical schools and the teaching hospitals, and we plan on doing that in conjunction with the NPA, National Grand Rounds in Chicago. So we really are hoping that we have a lot of student involvement and a lot of physician involvement as well in the Chicago area, as well as just, you know, around the United States, because you can get involved even if you're not necessarily in the city of Chicago, because we really want to make sure the students know that the scorecard is a tool, whether they're a pre-med or a medical student, it is something that they can use to, you know, dissect the colleges that they're scoring to make sure that there are no outside influences that are going to affect the way they receive medical education and how they end up, you know, practicing and treating patients.
Great. Well, thanks, Chantrice. Appreciate that. So at this point, again, I want to have everyone hit their *6. If you had put yourself on mute, unmute yourself and just jump in. We're going to have an open mic session. And again, what I'm sort of asking you to do is share with us all, you know, how you became interested in this topic, what lit your fire about conflict of interest and medicine industry relationships, and what do you think is the best way and the most effective way to learn about these issues? So who's going to jump in first?
So I'll shout at one. That's what I was worried about.
Now, we can have a Quaker meeting here. We can just be very quiet and wait till somebody says something.
I do have a couple of questions. I'm not sure if that would help spark some interest in other people speaking up. But I also don't want to dominate the conversation here. One simple question, Steve, is can you suggest when students should be exposed to certain courses or curriculum on conflicts of interest? Is it something that students should have right at the beginning of their medical training, or is it something that should be ongoing? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. And again, I'd like to hear from others as well, because you know, I think we're all experts on this. Yeah, I think the more the better. Certainly at the very first year in medical school, I think this can be incorporated into what, you know, often goes under the label of doctoring courses. As students, you know, go out into the community to be sensitized to these practices, because they're going to see them. Well, no matter what our policies might be in the mothership medical schools, when the students are out in the community, you know, learning to be doctors, you know, they may encounter this, and I think it's important to present it at that time. Certainly in ethics courses, again, I think conflict of interest is just an example of much broader issues than ethics, but it's an excellent example and can raise the whole issue of conflict of interest, not just in terms of industry relationships, but conflicts of interest in other things as well. Again, at the Einstein resources, they had a gene scientist named Jim Wilson come in and talk about what had happened. I think it was at Hopkins, where one of the patients died. And the protocols were suspect because the medical school had equity interest in the products that they were looking at, you know, and how institutions can have conflicts of interest as well. Did somebody say something? No? Okay. You know, I think certainly in those first 2 years at the University of Iowa, they have a wonderful course called Clinical Beginnings, which is something they put together for all rising third-year students just before they go out into their clinical courtships to go over conflict of interest policies and what to expect and what to do, kind of forewarning the students and making them think about, well, what do I do if I'm sitting down and suddenly, you know, a drug company rep comes in with a big Chinese banquet and puts it out there, you know, should I eat it, should I not, how do I deal with these kinds of issues? So again, they're kind of sensitizing the students before they actually encounter it. During the clinical clerkships themselves, a wonderful time to do this, you know, as students begin to see how marketing can influence the clinical decisions about what drugs to use, what devices to use, to talk about what evidence is available. And then certainly in residency as well. So I don't think there's a single point in the continuum where it isn't appropriate inject the teaching about conflict of interest.
Hey, Steve, I want to follow up on that. This is Jeff Cochi, the Director of Education and Research for AMHSA. Since you're talking about the spectrum of student education and when is it appropriate to address these issues with them, Cantrice and I are actually going to be spending some time next week in San Francisco with about 1,000 pre-health advisors and a few hundred pre-med students for the National Pre-Health Advisor Meeting. And we're going to table and promote the scorecard actually as a tool for pre-medical students to use as they evaluate the medical schools to which they intend to apply. And we're going to also promote the scorecard as a tool of advising for pre-health advisors who will be advising the students on the full range of considerations to make about medical schools and what medical schools to apply to. And we feel that the scorecard is an underutilized tool in the advising world, one that really hasn't really been framed that way. But given that pre-medical students are for their own development as pre-med students are doing volunteer work in hospitals or in clinics, they are getting exposed to they're getting exposed to the same dynamics that the medical students and even the residents are exposed to. So undergraduate pre-medical students need to be aware of these issues as well. It's not just something that needs to be addressed at the medical school level.
That's great, Jeff.
Steve, you had mentioned, this is Mary Lou Hickman, retired. You had mentioned, what do some of us recall, from the older days. And my concern, as I hear this, is that it would never have occurred, to me, in training or the colleagues I was with, that you would prescribe a medication just because you heard something from a pharmaceutical company. And so my really concern with medical school curriculum as it stands now is how, if you assume that all pharmaceutical companies are lying or that there is this conflict of interest, how do you really then learn and where do you go to get the actual facts for a drug that is really useful and helpful? And I can recall in the older days, that we used certain companies to really do training for community physicians when we were desperate to get a new drug for seizure control, that was so delightful to have a company come in and fund the cost of training so that community physicians would really say, look, there is a new drug in our armamentarium. So I think one thing that one has to address is how then do you advise medical students to how to determine, whether a proposed new drug is worth prescribing without the conflict of interest concern.
Right. When you and I were medical students and residents,
yes,
Mary Lou, getting the data wasn't as easy as it is today. I mean, we have to actually lug ourselves to the library and pick up those huge textbooks of medical indicas and try to look things up. Now, that information is at every medical student and every resident's fingertips instantaneously. I subscribe to the medical letter. I find it quite easy to get good data on drugs through what I consider to be a good, reliable, unbiased source. So I think the technology has made it a lot easier for people to do that. And if there ever was a legitimate reason, although I doubt it, but if there ever was a legitimate reason for letting drug reps come in to tell you about the newest drugs, I don't think that exists at all anymore. We all have access to that information, like I said, at our fingertips. When I first went into practice, I didn't know any better, and my older partner always had drug reps coming in, and I thought I was expected to do that as well, and I thought I would learn from them. But after just a few meetings, I realized I was busy as heck. Yeah, I was just wasting my time. That this was not a good use of my time because I couldn't trust any of the information that they had. I realized that they really didn't know what they were talking about. They weren't well educated in terms of in-depth understanding. They were certainly well trained in terms of how to present their company's products. But I soon said, forget it. I don't want to see these people anymore. It's a waste of my time.
So, Steve, that was a great answer, and you referred to the medical letter, which I'm guessing people have heard of. But do you want to talk just really quickly about that, and if there are other resources, or is that just pretty much common knowledge for medical students?
Yeah, no, I mean, the medical letter is a subscription journal. I think it comes out every couple weeks, 2 weeks. And it's not very expensive. It's maybe $100 a year or something like that. And there's no drug company advertising. It's all about subscription. They've got excellent consultants who weigh in on new drugs. I find it a great resource. Death by Drugs from Consumer Reports is another. Prescreer, which is a European publication similar to Medical Letter, is available in English. I think it may be either a Swiss or a French publication, but that has an English language publication as well. So, there are many good resources like that.
Are there others who want to add to the conversation or have questions for Steve or Chantrese? I do have another question, but I want to see if there's somebody else that would like to jump in.
Hi, this is Lisa Pymate from Seattle. I'm an internist. I'm in practice for many years, and I had similar experiences where, honestly, in medical school, I wasn't aware of any drug reps. I don't think we had them around, and we were certainly trained, particularly in infectious diseases, to order the most narrow spectrum, least expensive antibiotic and that sort of thing. And then I had academic training during my residency. And then when I first went into practice, I was at a VA for a while, and then at Group Health Cooperative of Puget Sound, which has its own formulary, and I served on the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee for several years. And they made very rational decisions. So I quickly became aware through them of a lot of the ways that pharmaceutical companies would come at people in practice, and they were simply not allowed at Group Health at all. So I was very shielded from any of these problems. And then we happened to go spend, my husband and I crossed the country and were at a university for a year. And I was in a teaching position in a general internal medicine clinic in a city, and big city clinic, and I was absolutely floored that every single one of their conferences was sponsored by a drug rep. And I brought that up to the faculty. I said, why is this being allowed? I said, this is really not good for medical students. It's not good for residents. It's giving them completely the wrong idea. This is totally unethical. And they all looked at me like I was insane and said, we couldn't get the students or the residents to come to lunch or come to any of the conferences unless we gave them free lunches. And I thought back about how I had certainly, gotten a bag lunch and gone to conferences because we had to go. So I don't know. I was very surprised by all that. And I later, for a brief period of time, was in a practice where there were drug rep lunches, and it's always been against my grain. And one question I have is that I know here in Seattle, the state of Washington, the American College of Physicians, when we meet and have our annual scientific session, we have for the last probably 5 years or even more chosen not to have any drug rep sponsorship, and we all agreed to pay more for our tuition to do that. And I don't know how common that is, and I'd be curious what others have to say.
Right. I'd like to hear if anyone on the phone has any personal information about that. You know, it is something that I think is growing. I don't know very many doctors who can't afford to buy their own sandwich. For some doctors, I think that they continue these things more for their staff. When it comes to saying, well, you know, we're now affiliated with this medical school, and the medical school conflict of interest policy said we shouldn't accept gifts, including food, from pharmaceutical companies, it's a good excuse for them to do something that they know they should have done a long time ago. If a hospital or a medical school, you know, can afford it, it's certainly nice to provide sandwiches or something for students and residents who may find it a little more difficult to buy their lunch. I think, again, we have to articulate, you know, why we're doing this. We're doing this because it's the right thing to do. It's the ethical thing to do, to talk about how these small gifts do influence behavior and why we want to do only the best things for our patients.
So this is Ann again. I do have a question that somebody asked, and I'm not sure if you can respond to it or not, but how is curriculum development linked to COI policies in general? Do universities or medical institutions do what they teach? And I don't have a good sense for that, I'm guessing the AMSA scorecard could probably provide some indication if somebody has good curriculum, or do they have other policies that are also rated well? And I don't know if you have any experience with that, Steve, or not.
Right.
Or Chantrice, for all that matters.
Exactly. Like I say, you know, Chantrice and Jeff jumped in as well. There is one of the measurement metrics on the scorecard is the curriculum, and schools are asked to discuss, you know, how COI is taught at their medical schools, and if they're willing to share actual curriculum materials on the scorecard. And if you do go there and those materials are available, you can download them. And I actually did get some excellent materials by doing that. Some schools, a small number, a minority, actually have policies that say, you know, we will teach this. This is an important part of the curriculum. And as a school policy, they articulated the importance and necessity of teaching about conflict of interest in the curriculum. Most of the schools, though, I think are doing the teaching, but it's not, they don't have a policy in place specifically that says they have to do that teaching.
I can add something to that. Our scorecard does have a domain that's specifically it for the COI curriculum, but it also has other domains because we not only want to look at if you're teaching these policies, but we want to look at how you're interacting in other areas as well. So it looks at if you allow pharmaceutical reps on your campus at all, because you may have a conflict of interest class or presentation that you do, but then if you turn around and allow reps on your campus that kind of defeats the purpose. So we look at, you know, overall behavior. Another domain is if you require disclosures, meaning if someone is doing a presentation, do they have to say, well, I am affiliated with this pharmaceutical company, or I am on an advisory board for Eli Lilly. So we look at those things to make sure that you're not only teaching your students, but you're also implementing these in your everyday interactions. I don't know if that answers the question.
No, no, that's really helpful. And I mean, I know that the new scorecard isn't out yet, but do you or Jeff want to just give a plug for when the new scorecard will become available, and then just let people know where they can find the existing scorecard in case they have not looked at it in the past?
The current scorecard, which is for the 2013 school year, is still online. It's available to look at and compare schools, and it's at AMHSAscorecard.org. Our new scorecard for the medical schools will be released at the end of this month, June. However, we won't be able to update the releases when we actually have the teaching office to it as well, but it will be available online for anyone who wants to compare schools policies from last year to this year to see if they've evolved or if they're stagnant, anything like that.
Hi, Dr. Smith. Hi, Sean Teresa.
Hi.
Hi there. This is Trip Hines. I'm the AMHSA Vice President for Membership, and I'm soon to be a fourth-year med student. And I just had a quick question for you. One of the things I've kind of experienced this past year as a third-year med student is on, one particular clerkship that we have. I know one of the doctors that we were with having to shadow was also the course director for that particular clerkship, and is the one who ended up evaluating us at the end. And usually on an average day, he has anywhere from 2 to 3 farm reps come into his office, provide lunch, that sort of thing. And, I know myself, I would just tell them, no, thank you. I'm just going to go eat lunch at the hospital. But I know several of my classmates felt just uncomfortable saying no to that sort of thing, and kind of how you can, any advice as far as what we can tell other students or just for myself as far as ways to say no, and or especially if someone's going to be evaluating you in the end.
Right. Yeah, those are always difficult issues, not just in COI, but in a whole range of things. And it's not going to end with your third year. I wish I could say it would, but, you know, going on to residency, you'll also find situations where you're in a power disparity situation like you were in, where there are behaviors that you observe that really don't meet the highest standard of professionalism, and what do you do about it? First of all, most of those situations you should have, some other person, faculty member, an advisor, a dean, who you can talk to, and just process through that, be able to talk about how you felt about it. Even if you don't change the practice, the ability to talk about it, analyze it, reflect on it, and help you develop your own value system or strengthen your own value system, I think is really important. And then after you get through with that, I'm not saying you should fall on your sword and flunk the rotation by having a militant confrontation with the faculty member. But once you've gotten through with that, if you're motivated enough, and obviously if you're on this call, you probably are, to go to the administration in your school and say, we've got to do something. We've got to strengthen our policies. This is not the way I think you, meaning the dean or whoever you're talking to, you know, want us to learn. I would think that you would want us as students and as graduates of this fine institution to practice at the highest level of professional standards and use your experience as a way of trying to bolster the policies at your school and the way they're implemented.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for asking the question, because that probably is one of the most difficult situations to be put in, I believe, especially when you want to do something about it. So thank you for asking. We have just a couple minutes left, and I don't know if anybody has other questions, or Steve, do you have any final thoughts, or Chantrice?
No, I don't have anything more, Ann. I appreciated the comments, and especially that last question by the student. I thought that was a great way to wrap it up.
I just want to mention a couple of things. We talked about the tool, or Steve actually talked quite a bit about the toolkit that's available as a result of the of project work. And I want to let people know that that toolkit, as well as other toolkits on different issues related to conflicts of interest, can be found on the Community Catalyst website, and they have a conflict of interest policy guide for medical schools and academic medical centers. And I'm looking at it right now. I don't have a simple way to get to it except for to say if you just, do a Google search of Community Catalyst conflict of interest, I believe the policy guide will come right up. I want to thank everyone again for joining us tonight and remind you that the audio recording and notes from this call will be posted on the National Physicians Alliance website at npalliance.org/conflict-free, along with recordings and notes from our previous calls in the series of conflict of interest calls. And there are other resources, as we've touched on, the Unbranded Doctor project, and there are also national grand rounds where our docs on the call can actually receive continuing medical education credits for a few of them. So I would urge you to check out the National Physicians Alliance website conflict of interest page to learn more about those resources. Please watch your email for the date and information about our next call, which we believe is going to be on July 30th. So if you want to mark your calendars now, we'll be sending out a promotion for that. And again, as Jeff or Chantrice mentioned, the AMHSA Harm-Free Scorecard is available on the AMHSA website at www.amhsascorecard.org. So I'm going to stop there. I'm going to thank everyone for joining us tonight and look forward to talking with you next month. Thank you.
Good night.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.